imposter syndrome is one of those things that we, if we think of it as something not to get rid of, but something that actually pops up because we're doing something challenging or something new or something where we're actually putting ourselves up for the biggest gains in life, then you can start seeing the imposter as a friendly sine-waving monster that's actually pointing you in the right direction, right, as opposed to, oh, I'm feeling the tension. Oh, I don't know if I can do this. I'm going to run away.
Yeah.
It's recognizing that and saying, ooh, I really don't think I can do this, but I'm going to try.
Welcome to season 4 of the Drawing From Experience podcast, your source of relatable advice for the everyday artist.
I want you to pick up your pencils, pick up your paintbrush, pick up your instrument, or whatever it is that you do.
Because let's face it,
this world is so much better with your art in it.
I'm here to remind you that you are one of a kind and the only one who does what you do.
And I want you to discover what it is that makes you shine. My name is Shane Isikowski, and I want to help build and create a future we all deserve. Hello, you beautiful humans. This is Shane Isikowski, your host of the Drawing From Experience podcast. Thank you so much for joining us yet again. This is episode number 121 with a good friend of mine named Rick Kitagawa. He is a leadership coach and an author, all kinds of things. He's also an artist in the dark art community. And he and I talked today about the ever-popular topic of imposter syndrome, which I know that I deal with regularly. I'm sure that a lot of people listening, if not everyone listening, has dealt with it at some point in their life. And this is something I've talked about in the past on episode number 19, which I will link in the show notes here. But I'm just completely stoked for you to listen to this episode and this conversation because it is something that pops up regularly in the art community from people of all backgrounds. So it is something that we do need to figure out how to deal with when it does pop up. And Rick and I really have some good conversation about it, and he has some amazing tactics on how to fight against it, I guess I'll say. Well, we'll get into it. And, you know, Rick is just a unique voice in the art world. So I'm just feeling really lucky to have him on this podcast to talk about these things. Before we get into the episode, I just want to take a second to talk to you guys about a show that I'm curating in San Francisco with Lena from Palette Gallery. She's the gallery manager there in San Francisco. And the show is called The Evil Among Us, and it deals with apotropaic magic. And if you don't know what that is, it is derived from the Greek to ward off or turn away from, and it's intended to repel harm or evil spirits. And this show is going to be amazing. If you are in the San Francisco area, you can come out September 10th. I will be there. Potentially some of the artists will be there, and you can see this amazing show in person. The show is featuring work by Kayleen De Jesus, Lynn Feifei, Jesse Hardesty, Diane Hoffman, Stephanie Inagaki, me, Adam McCarthy, Anneli Nakat, I am so sorry, Anneli, Spine Stealer, and also the amazing Chet Czar. So please come out, check out this show. The opening is Friday, September 10th, 2021. From 5 to 8 p.m. at Palette Gallery, which is located at 816 Folsom Street in San Francisco. Come out and say hello. And now, without further ado, this is my interview with the amazing Rick Kitagawa. On today's episode of the Drawing From Experience podcast, I have in the studio, in person, for the first time in I don't even know how long, since obviously before quarantine. Oh, wait, you know what? I did have some during quarantine with safe people, I promise. But I have Rick Kitagawa here in my studio. Welcome to the Drawing From Experience podcast, Rick.
Thank you so much for having me, Shane.
Yeah. So this is a long time coming. I've been a fan of your work for a very long time, since before I knew you. And I think we've talked about this before, but people, this weird thing happens to, I'm going to say people of similar race or ethnicity, and also into similar interests. When you get, you end up in a community, you see where I'm going with this. You end up in a community and people are like, oh, you're somebody who likes weird things. And then there's another person who also likes weird things. And you also happen to both be Asian. Then people are like, you should meet this other Asian that's into weird things.
Exactly.
So I remember hearing about you in San Francisco before you moved. And I bought some of the ties that you were making ties for a while.
Yeah, screen printing, kind of creepy tie designs. Like one, there's like the viper fish, and then there's just blood drips on one, and the biohazard design.
I had some of the, I'm going to say, nicer ones, surprisingly. I had one that was like a street scene in San Francisco with like crows or something like that.
Oh, yeah. I think, well, okay.
Oh.
To be fair, I think that might have actually been Cody's.
Oh, okay.
From
All
Binary
right.
Winter Press.
What about, there's an owl.
Also
Wait, is,
Cody.
Are
I
you serious?
I think these are both
these
Cody's.
These weren't yours?
Okay, so this actually happens with me and Cody all the time, is that people think my stuff is his and they think his stuff is mine. And people will come to my store saying, hey, I bought your tie. And I'm like, actually, you bought Cody's. And Cody tells me that people say the same thing to him. And so we've since, well, I don't really do the ties as much because I don't have this. I used to run a t-shirt printing studio, and so I had full silkscreen studio access. And now that I don't, after moving down here, but it's totally cool. So don't worry. We can
wait. So you guys are friends though.
We're totally friends.
And okay.
We go to a lot of the same conventions, and people have literally bought a tie from me and gone to Cody, and vice versa. And they're like, "I'm back for that tie," and I'm like, "Oh, that's actually."
Wow.
This other thing. Because we're the only two people on the West Coast that do ties. And we're also the only ones that do really creepier ties.
Okay.
Although Cody's gotten more into like more like design kind of stuff. Like he has this really amazing like fleur-de-lis mixed with D20s that are what's probably my favorite tie that I haven't made myself.
Cool.
It's actually my favorite tie, period. So... And because I don't do ties now, if you want, you can always go to binarywinterpress.com, I believe. But Cody Vrosh.
That's his
stuff.
Wow, you gave a plug to him, too. Look at that. Now people are going to be even more confused.
Totally. I'll be like, go get this D20 tie that I did not make.
Well, anyway, this whole time I thought I've been collecting your work, and here we are. anyway, so... What's funny is, let's see. So we had met after you moved?
After I moved, yeah.
Yeah.
It was at one of the dark art shows down here.
Right, okay. All right,
sorry. It was one of those things, exactly. We've been kind of ships passing in the night in San Francisco art scene, and we have a bunch of mutual friends and curators that we both know and work with. And then it was just, we didn't actually ever... We were never at a show at the same time.
Right.
I think like I would usually come early and have to leave, and you would come later and party, and we would just miss each other all the time. They're like, "Oh, did you see Shane?" And I'm like, "I've missed him yet again." And so it wasn't until we made a conscious effort to show up into the gallery. I was like, "What time will you be there? I will go there then."
Oh, that's so funny.
That we finally met.
Man. Okay. Well, here we are.
Here we are.
You know, I'd like you to introduce yourself a bit. I'm just going to kind of run through this list of things you do, because you do a lot of things. And also, we're going to get to the reason why we're even talking today about imposter syndrome. But Rick here is somebody who, he writes short horror fiction. He's also an author of this book that he just gave me called The Future is Trust. Do you have any other books besides this?
I do have a collection of really old short stories now, and it's kind of like a mix of my writing as well as some process stuff and kind of the collection of my paintings from I think 2008 to 2012 2013, I think. So it's like, it's a lot of my older work that very, very varied, I should say. But yeah, that one's called From the Darkness Creeps.
Cool. Okay. You're also a painter, sculptor. You cast and print and design. You know, I know you very much from the toys that you're making. What was that? DesignerCon that we were at together? And you also have a Patreon where you show some of that process and some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Blog. You have a blog?
I do have a daily blog. It's mainly focused around kind of leadership, culture building, building trust, and that can be found at rickkitagawa.com/blog.
I will post all of these links in the show notes for this episode. You also have the Inner Monster podcast. How is that going?
The Inner Monster podcast is going well, but also slowly growing, I should say. It's a very...
I feel your pain. I feel you.
It's a very... even more so niche podcast, I would assert, because it starts off with a very, the intro is kind of a short horror story that leads and introduces you into the monster of the week. And then I'll briefly touch into the mythology behind it, as well as how I'm personally connected to it. And I use that as inspiration to then rant for another, you know, 10 minutes or so around some topic around leadership or personal development. So it really has this interesting cross mix where you need to be really into culture and leadership and building trust and success and reframing value, and also be into monsters.
Right. So I mean, what a crazy cross section. I feel like that's such a good way to take all your personal interests and then turn them into something that you can teach to other people in a certain way about other things that you're passionate about, like leadership and trust. And you know, again, a huge reason why we're talking to you today is because you also run leadership workshops, offer organizational consulting on building trust at scale, which means with large companies, and you coach individuals around imposter syndrome, leadership, creativity, and business. What are the other reasons why you are uniquely qualified to talk to a group of artists who will potentially be listening to this podcast about imposter syndrome?
Well, I think the most unique part about me is that my own imposter syndrome is huge. And I think it's really, you know, as a creative, I know what it's like to, you know, put yourself out there and then have that fear of rejection, or, you know, like I've definitely had shows where no one comes, let alone buys anything.
Yeah, right? Not like, just the fear, like the actual reality of rejection.
Totally.
Sometimes constantly. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and plus also being in a relatively more niche art space, right? It's like I find myself unwilling usually and unable to do things that I know will sell. And it ends up being, I just need to make stuff for myself.
Yeah.
And whether that's super niche, like the Inner Monster podcast, or if it's, you know, even dark art, which is a relatively small field comparatively, and a very much smaller market compared to portraits of beautiful women, you know, or a lot of other
animal portraits or landscapes or things like that, that you can essentially hang, you know, anyone is okay with hanging a landscape. Not everyone's okay with a bloody monster.
Totally. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. So how long have you actually been doing these leadership workshops? And do you have certification? Like, how did you even get into that? How does that work?
Totally. And that's a great question. Speaking of imposter syndrome, so I don't have any certifications around leadership. Womp.
Okay, interview done. Sorry. It's been nice talking to you. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah. I actually got started by, I took a online synchronous course called the Alt MBA, founded by Seth Godin, who's a pretty big marketer and thought leader. And so I took that. I got out and I was approached by the current provost to see if I'd be interested in coaching. I then very hesitantly battling the imposter syndrome of who am I to be coaching a bunch of people who are, you know, VPs at Salesforce and directors at Starbucks and Warby Parker and Google and all of these other companies. And basically, as a small business owner, I used to run a t-shirt printing company, like I mentioned, you know, I was feeling a lot of hesitation around, oh, can I coach these people who literally make what I used to make in a year, like in a month?
Yeah.
Right. And so it's it's really staring all of that imposter syndrome in the face. And the first time I coached for the Alt MBA, literally the first question I was asked is, how long have you been coaching?
Oh my God.
And I'm just like, well, this is my first time. I've been coaching actually for a week now.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to sit with that. And since then, I've been tapped to coach a kind of exclusive director level and above version of the Alt MBA that actually happened right as a pandemic started. I've been asked to now head coach, and I was also the interim director of student experience. And I've since, because of my focus with Spotlight Trust, and also for a variety of reasons, none of which are bad, but more about trying to build transparency and build process into and equality into Akimbo, which is the parent company that runs the Alt MBA and other educational workshops. I declined the position, a full-time position, to help, and now I'm consulting with them to build out a bias-reducing hiring process for their two new director-level hires. So, I kind of went from teaching at the university or the Academy of Art University, forgot the name of my old school. I was teaching business and career skills for creatives there for about 5 years. And then I took the Alt MBA, eventually ended up moving to Pasadena, California, because my wife got a job down here. So we moved. But over that time, I had been, you know, coaching. I think I've been with Alt MBA since 2018 now. Mm. So it's been about 3 years of working with them. And yeah, it's something very interesting. As someone with no corporate background, I end up coaching founders, leaders. I've been very fortunate to coach people from every continent except for Africa and Antarctica now. And so, and this is all over Zoom, which is pretty phenomenal. And so it's really pre-pandemic, it was really a cool way. Now it's like everyone's like, oh yeah, you just Zoom with everybody. But back then it was kind of novel to be able to be coaching leaders from around the world.
How does this happen, Rick? How do you, I think about this all the time when I'm in a situation where I'm like, I don't know how I ended up here, but I'm here now. And now I have to like follow through with everything that I said I can do, you know? So like, just to give a little advice for people or just, you know, some insight into, you know, you explained how you actually got into that position and everything, but do you have any specific advice for people who find themselves in this spot where they're like, oh my God, now I have to do this thing that I'm not even sure I'm qualified to do? And this, of course, ties completely right into the imposter syndrome conversation.
Totally. I mean, practical advice is just, you have to say yes. First, you have to be willing to show up on the page. And even if you're not sure, it's, you know, if it's something you want, obviously, if you feel like this could be a great opportunity and I don't know if I'm qualified, you got to say yes first.
Yeah.
Right. Because if you turn down that opportunity, you're never going to know. And really, I personally would rather try and then kind of screw up.
Totally.
And then I'm like, okay, I'm actually not at that level yet, or this is actually above my head, or I need to study more. I need to go learn more. I need to train more or watch more YouTube tutorials or take an online class or whatever.
Regardless, it's going to be a learning process, learning experience for you, regardless of whether or not you take it and fail or take it and succeed, you know? And exactly what you're saying, like, I completely feel the same way. I'm like, I would much rather say yes to something. I don't even know if it's going to work out. I'd rather live with the failure than the regret. You know, the regret is, to me, is like, it's hard for that to go away. But the failure is, I'm like, you know what? At least I tried to do it. It gave me some more perspective on the subject.
Totally. I mean, I think so much is reframing, like, no one likes failure, right? Like, that's, I'm not going to lie to you and be like, oh no, like, failure is great. I'm like, no, failure sucks. Yeah. Like, no one likes failing, but what it is, it's about realizing that you can still learn from failure, right? Regret, you can't really learn from that because
it's gone, here and gone, and yeah, it's something that you can't just go back and redo it. So yeah, let's try to take this corporate idea of like find these leaders of these giant corporations and stuff like that, and now you're speaking to a room of artists, okay? You as an artist, this is why I feel like you're uniquely qualified for this talk. And if you go back through my episodes, way back when this podcast was a baby, it was episode number 19, and we talked, Sonia and I had talked about imposter syndrome, and we went on this kind of thorough conversation about it. And so I want to bring up some of the things that we spoke about before, and I wanted our listeners to go back and listen to that episode and hopefully take some things from that as well. And I want to reiterate some of what we've already spoken about, but having this fresh new perspective from somebody who talks about this all the time. One thing that we spoke about before was about how we do this thing where we try to like lessen the impact or make ourselves seem like we're not as skilled as we are, to kind of introduce ourselves to a person and maybe not feel like we're setting the standard for who we are like really high. So then if that person calls you out on something and it's like, actually, you're not a master at what you're saying you're a master of. This is something that I kind of do sometimes where like I'm showing somebody a painting and I've caught myself doing it, and I'm just like pointing out, like showing them a painting and pointing out what I don't like about it. So that way, if they saw that, it wouldn't be as big of a deal because I know it's wrong or something, you know? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know if there's a
name for that or what.
Well, I like to think of that as sort of, it's a defense mechanism that works really well in arguments when you're like, well, I'm going to say this, and well, this is what's wrong with it, and this, and this, and this. And so I'm basically just taking away your ammunition so you can't say anything, right? I mean, it's what Eminem does in the 8 Mile battle, right? It's basically like these are all the things I know you're going to say, so now you don't have anything, and now you look like a dumbass.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like,
totally.
And at the end of the day, that's really just a fear of being called out on something.
Yeah.
Right? And because that's never fun, but I think so much of dealing with imposter syndrome is, I think a common perception is that we're trying to get rid of imposter syndrome because it doesn't feel good. It keeps us playing small, I like to say, or it really holds us back from maybe being bold or going after opportunities that maybe we would get if we actually tried, instead of us self-censoring and holding things back. And the way I like to think about imposter syndrome is really reframing it as actually your friend. And so that's why in my own private coaching business, Kaiju Coaching, it's named after the giant monsters from, you know, Godzilla and Pacific Rim and stuff like that. And because I think of, we all have, I named it Kaiju Coaching partially. One, I love monsters, obviously. I'm on this podcast with you. Two, all of the kaiju used to be people in big rubber suits. And at the time, they're really scary. But we now look at this and we're like, that's silly because there are people in giant rubber suits. And they're not even, they weren't even constructed super well back then. Like, they were cool, but they're still kind of, you know, rubbery. It's not the practical effects we have now. And that's really what imposter syndrome is, right? It's just this outer shell that looks scary, but is just kind of you in a big rubber monster suit.
Yeah.
And it holds you back. But at the same time, imposter syndrome is one of those things that we, if we think of it as something not to get rid of, but something that actually pops up because we're doing something challenging or something new or something where we're actually putting ourselves up for the biggest gains in life, then you can start seeing the imposter as a friendly sine-waving monster that's actually pointing you in the right direction, as opposed to, oh, I'm feeling the tension. Oh, I don't know if I can do this. I'm going to run away.
Yeah.
It's recognizing that and saying, ooh, I really don't think I can do this, but I'm going to try.
Right. I love that, like reframing the idea when it pops up, when it comes into your life. And essentially what you're saying is it's going to pop up at the times when you don't want it to most, at these really like pivotal moments in your life when you're trying to do something intense or something different that you're just like, I'm not sure if I can do this. And then of course that's when it rears its ugly little head. But what you're saying is to, like a mother would love an ugly child, you're saying to love it even though it's ugly.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think because you're never going to actually get rid of it. And yeah. So all you can really do, like, people are always like, how do I beat my imposter syndrome? I'm like, you can't really beat your imposter syndrome. All you can do is befriend it. And so it's really, so an exercise that I've done with literally probably thousands of leaders now at this point is it's really just asking them, think about a time that you felt really proud of an accomplishment, right? It could be big, it could be small, it could be having a hard conversation with an estranged family member. It could be posting your art on Instagram. It could be, you know, submitting to a gallery, right? It could be, you know, in some people's cases, launching a company, right? It could a new art print, running a sale, starting a Patreon, right? It's not about the size of the accomplishment, but it's about when you did something. It could be like a sport, right? It's like, oh, like I made, you know, the buzzer beater in my middle school basketball team and we won and it felt super awesome because everyone loved me or something.
Wait, what's a buzzer beater? Is that what you said?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I'm not a sports person, but I assume that is the term when like the ball has left your hands and then the time runs out.
Oh, one who beats the buzzer.
One who beats the buzzer.
I understand now, okay, sorry.
Or continue. A shot that beats the buzzer, yeah. but regardless, it's like, and you can do this now, Shane, since we're here. It's just like, think about a time that you felt really proud about something. That you accomplished something, that you felt that sense of pride, really.
Okay. My moment is going to be something I was pretty proud of at the time. I'm still proud of, but it's so long ago. But there was a project that I worked on in my town in Pennsylvania, and I saw the whole thing through to the end. It was public artwork in a town that was pretty devoid of public art. And then we came in, we put like one really large mural wall up and then 10 other murals around town.
Awesome.
So that's my moment.
Yeah. Okay. So regardless of the moment, what was it about that made you feel accomplished? Like, I think I know, but I'll let you.
Yeah, I think I'll say I had never at the time put together something of that scale. And, you know, when I look back on it, I have a lot of regrets on how I did things. And but, you know, I'm proud of the actual work that we accomplished, you know, in the small town. Yeah.
Okay. So this, you won't be surprised, falls in line with all of the other people I've done this with, and there's always a pattern, and there's usually three things. So it's either, and yours I would say is two of them. It's either, or maybe three, right? It's usually something that you've never done before, or you didn't think you could do. So it was like you said, it's nothing of the scale before, right? There's a sense of making an impact in some way. Like, you actually shipped all of these murals and you did this, you like, did something that no one had ever done in your town. Yeah. The third that often will come up is that people praised the person, or it's like, oh, that was amazing, thank you so much for doing it. There's a sense of accomplishment from other people.
Right.
And regardless, if you look at most of those things, you never do them unless you are pushing past the imposter, right? Because when you're doing something new, that's when the imposter comes up. Right. When you're putting yourself out there in order to do something that someone else could praise you for, that's when the imposter comes up. When you're doing something incredibly difficult and of substance, that's when the imposter comes up. And so if all of everyone's greatest achievements, every moment in their life where they feel like they've accomplished something, they feel like they've made a difference, those have all come from moments of you pushing past the imposter and showing up anyway. And so when you think about it as, oh, there's imposter. Ooh, I'm not sure if I can do that. That is a sign that says, think about what lies on the other side if you do achieve that.
This episode is sponsored by...
Diane Hoffman creates dimensional worlds of allegory with her collage and assemblage works constructed from salvaged and repurposed found objects. She uses organic materials from nature combined with industrial and figurative remnants to carefully depict the balance between light and dark by presenting the sincerity found in their unified stories. To find Diane's work and her current exhibitions, check out her website, D-I-A-N-N-E, HOFFMAN.net, and be sure to follow Diane on Instagram, Facebook, and join her Patreon, all found at Diane Hoffman Art.
Hello, DFE listeners. This is Rick, and I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. If you are feeling stuck with an artist block, upset at your own brain, scared of marketing or selling your art, or paralyzed about picking up that pencil, I've got a little something for you. After working with thousands of creatives and leaders around the world, I've built an online class run on Discord especially for the creative community, aka artists just like you. It's a 4-week class starting September 13th that you can work through on your schedule with videos, live calls with myself and other special guests, worksheets, and a supportive community to work through our fears together. So if you're looking to find a way forward in your struggle with imposter syndrome, I'd like to invite you to join me at kaijucoaching.com/imposter and use the code DFEARTIST to save 20% off your registration. Thanks so much. I hope to see you in September. And now, back to the rest of the convo.
I love that so much. Yeah. If you can take anything away from this conversation, I mean, I feel like that's something to keep in mind throughout all of that process of pushing. And like you're saying, the scale doesn't matter. This could be just you saying, I want to learn how to watercolor paint, you know, which I've never done before, you know, and it's your partner telling you how beautiful it is, you know, so you're receiving that praise from one person, you know. So yeah, I love that. I think that's like such a good thing, a good way to kind of
judo flip.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you for finishing my my thought there. I have a question for you. At which point, you know, I feel like we all experience. Have you met anybody who says they have not experienced imposter syndrome first and foremost?
Well, I always preface all of this imposter stuff with sharing my fears and what my imposter says, right? And my imposter says things like, "Who are you to teach these incredibly smart, talented, wealthy, successful people anything?"
Yeah.
Right? You're just some, you know, some kid from Stockton, California, you know, what do you know? Right? It's who even cares about your art? You suck. Right? Like that's my imposter. Like I hear the same things that everyone else hears. Right? And this is the other thing, is that surprisingly, maybe when a leader is willing to admit that they feel imposter syndrome, and then they ask everyone else to share, everyone else suddenly is like, I don't think I'm smart enough. I don't think I'm qualified enough. Oh, I've never done this before, and I think this other person is more deserving. Oh, yeah. My background of XYZ makes me unqualified. And that's the thing about imposter syndrome, is that if you are doing any kind of work that's moderately challenging, you're going to have imposter syndrome. And well, there's like the more medical definition of imposter syndrome, and then what I like to call just the inner monster. Everyone has the inner monster, which tells you that you're not good enough, you're not X enough. But right. It's really comforting, I think, for a lot of people to know that everyone has it. Because I've done this with senior vice presidents of Starbucks, you know, like people who make a lot of money and have a lot of influence in literally products that you would buy on an everyday basis. And, you know, work with people at Kellogg's, like these are huge companies, and these people have a huge amount of influence over their teams and products that come out.
So decisions that they make are going to have an effect on a lot of people.
Yeah. And they have the exact same fears as someone who is like, oh, you know, I don't see myself as a creative, but I kind of want a watercolor. Yeah. And that fear about, like, oh my gosh, like, I don't know what I'm doing. This is going to be terrible. This looks stupid. Like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm, like, this is looks so much easier in the YouTube tutorial. Like, this is right. So, like, hard. Right? And, like, it becomes, even if it becomes a mess and they fail that first time, you know, it's, like, that's the same fear. Right. It's a different scale for sure. And people have different levels of responsibility. And so sometimes there are really very real fears of consequences, right? Yeah. Of like, oh, you're running a multinational giant company versus watercoloring at home, different stakes, but that those fears are the same. And our body actually interprets fears pretty much by intensity, not by what it actually is, right? So if it terrifies you to go do public speaking or to post your artwork on the internet, right? If that terrifies you as much as maybe someone else who is like, I will literally lose $45 million if this goes wrong, right? Like that fear, we register that in our body the same, even if they're like completely, you know, objectively with different levels of consequence.
I see this a lot with people posting in the Drawing From Experience creative community. You know, every week I'm looking for works in progress. Every Sunday we do creative conquests. This is why I try to celebrate victories and things. But when people are posting their artwork, a lot of times people will, they'll say, I tried this thing, or they'll try to do that cushion.
The
that
modifier. Defense.
Yeah, and they're just like, I know this isn't really good, or like they'll say something right at the beginning to like discredit who they are or what they're doing, just so it doesn't feel as terrible, just in case somebody's like, you're terrible at watercolors, you know, which nobody's going to do in that group, you know, like these are all very encouraging people. And, but I see it so often with artists, you know, and this is one of the number one conversations that I have with people is about imposter syndrome, you know, and it just constantly, is coming up. You had brought up something about the, like the medical actual term and everything, that is something I very just quickly wanted to touch upon. It's forever been called imposter syndrome, but isn't it true that also it's not actually proven that it is a syndrome, and that technically, you know, it's not a mental disorder, and there are different terms that kind of describe it a little bit better, including imposter phenomenon, fraud syndrome, and imposter experience. Is there an update to that? Have we named it something different? What's the scoop?
No, I love, thank you so much for bringing that up, because I say the medical definition in the way that syndrome makes it sound like this, this like super crazy mental disorder.
I feel like this is part of why it's so scary.
Exactly.
To people.
Yeah. Exactly. People don't want to say, I have anything syndrome.
Yeah.
Right? Like it could be like, you know, I laugh at jokes and snort syndrome. Like, it's like, who cares? Like, that's fine. But yeah, that syndrome really stigmatizes it. And so that's why I kind of reframe it as the inner monster. And I do some other exercises with people about making it more fun and kind of a friendly monster, as opposed to that takes some of the seriousness out of it, because it's a really mean voice often. Because when you ask people to share what their imposter says, I guarantee you, no one, most people, because there's jerks out there, but I'll say face to face, no one would ever talk to other people the way they talk to themselves.
Totally.
And and because of that, it's super mean. But then when, you know, there's some exercises I get into with clients around changing the voice of the monster, or even drawing it and saying like, what does it look like? Right. And now what would it look like if it was wearing, you know, a clown costume? Clowns could be scary, and like with dark artists that could actually be really terrifying, but generally people who are not highly trained artists, you know, it's just kind of like, what would it look like if they were silly as opposed to scary, right? Like we initially think of fangs and, you know, sharp edges and stuff, and what if you change the shape for artists, what if you change the shape language to a circle instead of triangles, right? Or what if we just looked at it as a friendly monster? What would that look like? Or how could you make it look ridiculous? And so then you start taking the edge off of it, and it becomes this little funny friend who's like, you're not good enough. And you're kind of like, haha, like, oh, that's so cute, little weird shempy dude. Like, you're funny. Like, how cute. And it's not that, like, you're not good enough. And then you're like, oh my gosh, I feel so bad. Like, and it has this weight. It's alleviating a lot of that by personifying it and then turning it into its own friendly little thing that then can run alongside you. And you're like, yeah, you're right. People might say that, but I am qualified. And even if I'm not, I'm going to try. I'm going to see what happens.
Right. So what do you think of when somebody says the term or the phrase, fake it till you make it?
I think, like, I'm not necessarily opposed to fake it till you make it. I really like more of the reframe that I'm not sure if you're familiar with Amy Cuddy. She's a social scientist and a little controversial due to some of, like, I could get into this because I looked into this a lot, but she has a TED Talk that I would recommend everyone watch around power posing. And so it's this way of moving your body to make yourself feel more confident. And the controversy, just real quick, so people aren't like, what is this? I need to go see, is that she makes a claim that it actually changes you on a hormonal level. And there's been two studies to try to replicate it, but they didn't actually replicate it exactly. And so they were like, well, we're not seeing any actual hormonal changes. And so, but the
calm down, internet.
Yeah. Well, and it's also a bunch of dudes trying to discredit a successful woman. Right. So, that said, she's sort of, there's caveats when you watch the TED Talk that basically say the hormone stuff isn't necessarily scientifically proven, but there is a very robust body of evidence that shows by taking more powerful poses, like a lot of it is like, you know, more spread, your shoulders are back, they're much more what you would typically call like a confident pose.
Yeah.
Those do increase your confidence. And so regardless if it's at a hormonal level, it actually has been shown
more and more. It almost doesn't even matter if it's at a hormonal level, because all that matters is, how do you feel? Exactly. How do you feel when you do it? If you feel good, who gives a shit? You know, it's like, it doesn't matter. And I'm really glad that you brought up confidence, because that was going to be kind of the next part with the fake it till you make it thing, because you can have confidence without fully knowing what you're even doing, you know? And there's been times when I dove headfirst into a thing, I had no idea what I was doing, and then in the end, I accomplished something. You almost feel like when you think about it, it's not, it feels like not a good thing, where you're like, it's a fake confidence where you're going in and trying to do this thing. But also, it could be a good thing. You know, I feel like for myself, you know, as far as imposter syndrome goes, I didn't go to art school. I'm surrounded by artists constantly that are fucking amazing. And I'm like showing in the same galleries, literally showing in the same galleries on the same walls as them. And I'm like, I'm not classically trained. I've like taught myself. And also I've learned from a ton of different people. I'm learning from them just by looking at their artwork, you know? So I constantly have that kind of like trying to one up myself, but also going into situations where I'm not 100% confident, but I kind of have to be 100% confident going in to just get it done. And then, and almost just try not to even think about the confidence part of it, and just concentrate on the actual task at hand.
Yeah, I think what you're getting at, Shane, is being present in the moment, right? Because most of the fear comes from when we're like, oh my gosh, like I haven't done this before. What are they going to say? Blah, blah, blah. Like baggage, past things, past fears, current fears, right? But then when you're like, put the paint on the canvas, right? Put the pencil on the paper, right? Like, do the work. Like, who cares about it? And if you're focused on just, okay, I have this thing in my head, or I have a vague idea that I'm going to, you know, like everyone's creative process is different, that I'm going to try to copy, or like I'm looking at reference, I'm going to try to like make my painting look like this, like whatever it is, whatever process you're in, if you're truly present, none of that's going to matter.
Yeah.
And I think that goes back to Amy Cuddy, and she talks about, don't fake it until you make it, fake it until you become it. And part of that is that confidence eventually comes with you constantly facing the imposter, and then you do something, do X, right? Make another painting. Eventually you're like, oh yeah, like I can paint, right? And like, if you're not worried about diplomas, or which I can get into why I can go into education ad nauseum, but really it's, you know, it's becoming confident in what you do. And so this is a tricky thing, is because it feels like confidence is an end state. Like, oh, if I do this enough, right? If I, Malcolm Gladwell, if I put in my 10,000 hours,
right,
I will feel confident. The thing is, though, and this is why I think it's so key to think as of befriending your imposter, as opposed to being like, oh, eventually I'll be confident enough not to deal with the imposter. The thing is, if you're constantly growing, the arena that you play in is constantly going to grow as well.
Right.
And so by nature, you're going to feel confident about painting, but then it's like, well, do I feel confident painting next to these people in a gallery? And then you're like, okay, yeah, no, like, yeah, I've sold a lot of art. Like, I'm confident now. And then it's like, okay, now are you confident showing next to Banksy? Right. Or like, you know, like then like it always keeps growing. And then you're at the top and then you're like, am I confident to keep doing work that people are going to like?
Yeah.
And so no matter what, you're always going to be, if you are trying to grow, if you are trying to do anything that matters, you're constantly going to have that doubt in your head about whether or not you can do it, because you're constantly doing something new. You're playing in a new field, even if it's something you've done before. And so I think it's really thinking about, we talk to leaders a lot about something called confident humility. And that's really where it's, a lot of people think leadership is like, oh, like I'm the best. Look at me, how confident I am. Like I'm, you know, like I know everything. But confident humility is also understanding that you're confident that you can figure it out, or you can find the right person who knows how to do it, or you can marshal the resources, or you, like, you'll get it done, even if you don't know how to right now. And so part of that is we're trying, you know, a lot of the work I do on the consulting side and the training is helping leaders recognize that they can say they don't know something, right? Because people are so terrified to say, I don't know.
Totally.
To be fair, because a lot of times they get punished for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of it is changing the culture around making this normalized and making the leaders be the first ones to say, actually, you know what? I don't know, but I can find out the answer. Or like, I don't know, so let's work on this together.
Yeah. I respond to that so much better when somebody says that to me, where they're just like, I actually don't know, versus trying to come up with some convoluted fucking way to figure it out. And I'm just like, you have no idea what you're talking about, you know? And like, and I find myself, you know, throughout my life, I was kind of that way at certain times where I was just like trying to just play it off like I have it figured out. And what I always tell people is like, no one fucking has it figured out. And it's like, it's good that we don't. It's like, that means at the bottom or the top, everyone's kind of in the same boat. And the people at the top, if they're trying to delegate responsibilities, that's kind of their job, is to find people who know how to do it, you know, even if they do not, you know. So I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine, and we were talking about when you're working with people, and the really terrible people to work with are generally the people who are like not flexible at all, you know. And the people who are good to work with are like, okay, we'll figure it out, you know. They're the ones who are saying, who are literally saying that, you know. And that's kind of like an acceptance of like, I don't really know the answer, however, if we kind of work together, we can figure it out.
Totally. Know? Yeah. And I think that's really where people want to get to this place where like they're confident all the time and they're never worried about something. But like, to be honest, when you're at that place, you're just like piddling around, right? Like, when am I confident about, like when I'm not feeling any sort of doubt and I'm just like, yeah, I got this covered. It's like taking a nap.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, it's like getting into a fight with a toddler.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, I'm going to kick your ass, little kid, because it's like, yeah, I'm literally 10 times
not,
the size. Like,
it's not challenging.
There's no
all.
Challenge.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so another weird fact about me is I'm actually a nationally ranked skee ball player. Like, you know, the arcade game where you like roll the ball up the lane and it goes into holes, right? So last two national tournaments I've placed in the top 16.
Oh my God.
And so I am generally pretty good at skee ball. That said, when everyone knows this, so then what happens at bars when there's a skee ball machine, everyone's like, oh damn, we got a nesh, like, and then everyone wants to challenge you. Uh-huh. And on a just like one game of like nine balls, yeah, I totally could lose because like someone could just randomly get lucky and sink a bunch of hundreds. And then I'm like, well, now I really have to like be intentional, and that's difficult for the best of us, right? Yeah. So like, yeah, imposter syndrome all the time, even though I am like demonstrably better than most people at this game.
Yeah.
Right.
out of 20 games, you would do really well. But just randomly one game, potentially somebody else could better. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, my thing is, if I was betting money, I'd always say best of three and the other person goes first. And I'm pretty confident any random person in the bar, I will beat them at that.
Nice. Wow.
But then
we're
when
play.
I
play, we're playing sometime.
Yeah, let's do it. But then against obviously my peers in the league, that suddenly becomes a very different situation.
Totally.
And then my hands start shaking and like, you know, there's all this other stuff that goes into really high level competition. And so, yeah, it's understanding though, like I go into national championships knowing that there's people who are much better than I am.
Yeah.
But one, it's saying, okay, well, maybe they are better than me. But one, maybe I'll get lucky. And two, like, I can't assume I'm going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to go in there knowing or pretending, faking it, whatever you want to call it, that, you know, I'm better than them.
Yeah.
Or at least I can beat them, right? And that's something I am confident is that, like, yeah, on any given day, I could beat any other player.
Mm-hmm.
It's less likely with certain people who I'm like, demonstrably, you are have a much higher average than I do.
Yeah.
But it's still going in there saying, yeah, like I could lose, but so what? Like I'm going to have fun. I'm going to learn from it.
Creative Conquest.
Natalia Daraselia. Sorry if I mispronounced that, Natalia. But Natalia says, my first Etsy sale, handmade polymer clay. And that is found at etsy.com/shop/art by Natalia D. Congrats, Natalia. That is super exciting. Alex Blaine Dostal says, I just got hired for my second artistic gig. I'm just now, at 30, embracing my true calling, to create, even if it's in a much different way than I thought growing up. Alex, that is super exciting. I've been seeing some of your creative projects you have been working on, and that's just really awesome. I'm really, really happy for you. And my last creative conquest goes to, you guessed it, Mr. Rick Kitagawa. He says, I published a book of short horror stories and also designed the cover. The book that Rick is referring to here is called Tender Morsels, and it is a book of short horror stories from Rick here. So I will post a link to that in the show notes. If you'd like to share your creative conquest with us, you can find us on Facebook. Just look for the Drawing From Experience Creative Community, and you can start sharing today. Well, you bring up an interesting point about getting to a certain status, you know, and in the art world, artists have status.
Sure.
You know, you develop a reputation, you start showing in certain galleries, you start getting in publications. What do you have to say about that? Because what I've realized, and what I talked to an art group that I'm a part of about this conversation, was that the highest skilled people, the people that we all know and we look up to as these amazing artists, they still have imposter syndrome, you know? So when you reach a certain status and you're trying to essentially like not be dethroned, you know, it's like you're a nationally ranked skee ball champion. You don't want to look foolish the next time you play skee ball. So you want to kind of uphold this thing. But in the art world, it's a little different because we're not always in competition with each other. We're
totally
showing at galleries. So when you reach a certain place, I think what happens to some people is they get, it's almost like they get some kind of paralysis of like, oh, well, now I have to uphold this certain thing. And I don't know if I'm up for that challenge. I've already reached this status. I've already gone through all these challenges to get to the place. How do I uphold this thing without going crazy?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's the same fear, right? It's just a different type of fear. The first fear is I'm not going to get there. And then for when you've reached a certain level, it's, oh, I'm going to fall back down or something. Yeah. Like there's some ladder that you can, like literally you're climbing and it's like, I don't want to fall because it takes more energy to go up than it does to go down, right? Like that's the reality of most things, whether that's a reputation or physics, right? But I mean, I think for them, I would say it's really the same thing. I would try to focus on why you're doing what it is you're doing, right? It's once again, it's being present in the moment of creation and not thinking, oh, I need to win an award with this because I've won 4 Spectrum Awards and now I need to get a gold, you know? Like it's kind of like, yo, just focus on doing what you want to do, because I think at the end of the day, I look at success as really just, are you happy? And sure, I would probably be happy with more money and more clients and, you know, more international fame and recognition and billionaires flying me to their compound so I can paint a giant monster on the side of their castle, right? Like whatever, like.
Shout out to the billionaires out there if you want Rick to come paint a monster on the side of your castle.
I most definitely will. But, you know, like, at the same time, it's kind of like, if I'm always waiting for that, like, why wait for happiness? Or why wait for success? Like, I can, if I'm showing up and acting in a way that I feel is honorable and that I want to carry myself, like, I have a certain set of values and standards, and if I'm living up to that, like, that's success, right? And also, you know, paying my bills and, like, not starving and, you know, there's the realities of living in a capitalistic society that, like, yeah, there's, you might not be happy going to a day job when you wish you were making art, right? But I think at the end of the day, it's really specifically artists, like, you're making art for a reason, and you're realistically, you're not doing it because it makes a bunch of money.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you wanted to make a bunch of money, you could, like, go be a software engineer. It's a lot, it's surprisingly much easier than you might think, and you'd probably make a lot more money than trying to make it as a fine artist, especially in the short term, I should say.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, like, yeah, like, success can be anything you really want it to be. And I like to think of success for myself about, am I trying something new? Am I being generous? Am I being curious? Am I learning? And if I can say yes to a few of those in any given situation, I'll say, check, that's a success.
Man, awesome. I want to, before we wrap up, there are two main things that I want to talk about. One is the talking about monsters. Here it is, social media and how it plays into imposter syndrome. And the second thing I want to talk about are the tools to combat imposter syndrome.
Yeah. I think, and those kind of overlap with each other. I think about social media. Social media is hard because it's curated. It's so highly curated. And, like, I'll say even, like, work in progress stuff.
Right. Yeah.
People are showing, like, 90% done work in progress.
I'm guilty of this. I do this all the time.
So do I. I'm like, I mean, I try. Well, because I know that when I show actual work in progress, like, this is actually 50%, people are like, yeah, that's kind of ugly.
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of people don't, if you're not a creative, you don't
kind
of.
You have no idea.
You have no idea what 50% actually looks like, right? And you're like, oh, that's all muddy. Yeah, I haven't figured it. That's why it's a work in progress, right? Like, it's not almost finished. And then I put on the highlights and I'm like, okay, now I'm done. Yeah. I'm like, come on. Like, and I do that too, right? We all do it because we know, especially when you make money from art, there is financial gain to looking like, oh, I just whipped this out. And I'm like, that probably took you 70 hours of painting, right? Like I paint pretty fast, and a finished painting versus like, yeah, I'm happy enough to put this on Instagram. Those are two very different things.
Yeah.
And, or I should say, so because I work a little bit looser, I'm not quite as like, I don't render nearly as much as say you do, Shane. So my work looks rougher, and I try to keep it that way. So maybe the painting I show literally actually took me 3 hours to paint, and I'm like, oh, this is a finished, you know, 18 by 24, and it's huge, and like, I'm done with it. I also, that doesn't take into account maybe the 7 to 12 other 3 hour paintings I did that look like crap. And I'm like, ooh, right. This is bad. I'm gonna scrape this canvas.
Yeah.
And so social media is so curated because there is an incentive to curate. And because of that, it sets our expectations completely bonkers, and we start comparing ourselves to each other. And so I think in terms of tactics to avoid imposter syndrome, well, one, like I said, combating imposter syndrome is really befriending it. That's the most powerful thing you can do, is start to understand that like, this is a force of good that you actually want to be feeling, because that means you're doing something awesome. And if you're not there yet and you're still like, I still don't like this feeling, it's really, I think a big thing that makes this feel worse is comparing to others. And it's keeping, I would just say, keep in mind that you don't know what that other person's story is, right? You look at some person who's like, just started my Instagram, and then you see like they have like 70,000 followers, right? And you're like, oh my God, like people must, who is this person? And so then you follow them. And
right.
One, they could have literally bought those followers. Mm. So that's like one thing. Like, follower count means nothing in the real world. It means something to advertising.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean anything. Like, how many of those people are going to buy your artwork anyway?
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's an entrepreneur who talks about how he did this one experiment where it was a joint venture, and he like cross-posted on a blog. He got, I think it was 200,000 followers on his email subscription. How many people converted to actually buying something? Like 7.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? It's like the wrong audience. So I think something that I'd like to offer people is just remembering, who are you for, or who is your work for? Because this is so much about, this goes into like a lot into like marketing and copywriting and product market fit and things like that. But it's really thinking like, who is this artwork for? Who are you making it for? And if you're not, if you're showing dark art to people who don't like it, you're not going to sell anything. If you show abstract work to people who are dark artists, they're not going to buy it. You know, it's like, it's about finding the right people and not trying to please everyone. We all want to please everyone, but any company or product that has made mass market penetration in terms of like, you know, your mom, like I call it the mom test. It's like your mom would know about this brand or this product, right? It's not niche or something like, you know, like I have tons of respect for Chet Czar, right? In the dark art world, tons of like, all of us are like, yes, Chet, you're the grandfather of the dark art in a lot of ways. My mom doesn't know who he is.
Yeah, totally.
Right? And it's like, or the same thing with Seth Godin, right? Huge marketer, you know, New York Times bestselling author, I think 12 times over, something like that. Yeah.
But there's so many people who have no idea who he is.
Yeah. Or like the people listening might be like, who's this Seth Godin guy, right? And it's like, because he's not for you, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And so it's really understanding that you're not going to be for everyone. But if you can serve and create stuff for the people you are for, that's who actually matters. And so it's getting really clear about, who are you trying to reach? Who are you trying to connect with? Who might like your stuff? Like, care about those people. Like, screw all the other people who are like, man, blah, 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 I don't like this. We're like, oh, that's cool, but your color, it's like, they're not for you. Yeah. So their opinion completely doesn't matter. If it's for them, and then they're saying, I don't know, your anatomy is a little off, or like, oh, your person, okay. Now that's actual helpful feedback, and now you can actually focus on that and get better.
Yeah.
But if it's not for them, like, doesn't matter, right? Yeah. It's like, if you're not worried about your grandma buying your artwork because you're not making stuff for your grandma, then like, that's the same thing about certain galleries, right? There's tons of galleries that wouldn't show your work because they could be huge galleries. It's just, they don't sell that type of work. And it's understanding that it's not personal. It's just not a fit for them. And it's about finding the galleries or showing opportunities or creating your own spaces or whatever to find a tribe, foster the people you want to serve through your artwork and make stuff that they appreciate. Like, find those people and focus solely on them and completely be like, fuck everybody else.
Yeah, that is some sound advice, sir. Thank you so much for doing this. And where do people find you and potentially hire you for your services? Where do people go online?
Totally. You can find my kind of main hub is just Rick Kitagawa, RickKitagawa.com. And that has my daily blog. You can find links to one, my coaching website, kaijucoaching.com, to my consultancy, spotlighttrust.com. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, if you're interested in art, is at Rick Kitagawa. And innermonsterpodcast.com. I just have like a whole list of links I'm sure I could give you. But also patreon.com/Rick Kitagawa. That's actually the most inexpensive way to get my coaching if anyone wants to dive in deeper. Plus you get discounts on art. And if you like creepy monsters and want to deal with imposter syndrome, it's a great way to do it.
Love it. Rick, thank you so much for joining us. If you guys enjoyed this episode, you can stream and download previous episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or my website, drawingfromexperience.com. You can find us on Facebook and join the Drawing From Experience creative community and start sharing artwork with us in there. You can find us on Instagram at DFE Podcast or on Patreon at patreon.com/drawingfromexperience or my personal Patreon at patreon.com/ShaneIsakowski and also on my website at ShaneIsakowski.com and on Instagram and Facebook at ShaneIsakowskiArtist. Rick, thank you so much. I know people are going to get tons of stuff out of this conversation. I know I have, so thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Shane.
Thanks. I will talk to you guys next week. Bye-bye.